Father Christina, welcome back. Good to see you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's good to see you too.
So I'm very excited about our conversation today because we're going to cover some topics that I think that really need to be covered. And that topic specifically is MAID, Medical Assisted Assistance in Dying. This applies to Canada, but also to many countries and to many places our viewers are watching from. To start off with, Father, I think you had made a point as right before we started is to make a distinction between some of these terms so we're clear on what we're talking about.
Right. Well, I think that we live in a time of euphemisms, and so we call things by certain names so that they don't sound like what they actually are. And medical assistance in dying sounds like such a clean and healthy and helpful thing because we all have to die. And isn't it nice to be helped, receive assistance? And who values assistance more than when it's medical assistance, especially if they're already in some kind of medical distress? So I think they've put together a pretty clever-sounding euphemism. But what we're talking about here is basically two different ways of someone ending their life. One of them is when it is agreed to by the patient that their physician will administer a lethal injection to them, causing them to die. This is what is technically meant by the term euthanasia. And it's a Greek word, but the meaning here is that someone has, with your consent, maybe not always with your consent, but at least in the topic we're talking about here, with your consent, ushers in your death for you with intention. The other being what is known as assisted suicide. And assisted suicide is performed in kind of two different ways. One where your physician writes you a prescription, for example, or gives you the means necessary for you to end your life on your own timeline and more or less facilitates that being able to be done for you. But the other being the assisted suicide of you being another step removed from your doctor. Maybe you've been counseled up to that point, but then you take matters into your own hands. It's not a very obvious distinction, but I think you might say in one case, you do it to yourself in the hospital under medical supervision. The other case, they might just write you a prescription and you take it home and you go and have your last meal with your friends or something, and then you decide to do it on your own timeline. These are all terminating someone's life. But the way in which that happens, it needs to be clearly understood, particularly when we're talking about physicians, who at least in the origins of medicine, lived under the Hippocratic Oath to, first of all, do no harm to their patients, and not to administer to them any deadly substance, are now doing just that. And we are calling it, under such a sanitized-sounding name, medical assistance in dying, which must be completely differentiated from what we refer to as palliative care, which I think is true medical assistance in dying, because that is to say, this person is thought to be on their way out by medical standards, there is no prospect for recovery, and so we are going to assist them through their process of dying by keeping them comfortable, by accompanying them, trying to manage their pain or discomfort. That, I would say, is actual medical assistance in dying, because the palliative care physician is not ushering in their death. They're helping them arrive at death naturally.
Mm-hmm. So as we go forward in our conversation, if one of us happens to say MAID in Canada, that stands for Medical Assistance in Dying. Now, there could be one thing I want to bring up is it ever allowable to end a person's life prematurely to spare them from suffering? I can imagine some people who are watching or people who think, well, this person or I have just received I've just received news that I have a terminal illness, and now the road in front of me is going to be long and difficult and painful. I have all these medical procedures that will just prolong my life, but it's inevitable that I'm going to die and I'm going to suffer a lot, not a little bit, but a lot. And my suffering is also going to cause suffering for the people around me. They're going to see me suffer as well. Is it ever a merciful act to end a person's life before natural death? Can that be a merciful act? Because to many people, it would seem that that is.
Mm-hmm. I understand why people would see that as being merciful, but it is not, very simply put. And the reason is because we cannot take life into our own hands. This is expressly forbidden by God, who is the author of life. And I think we'll probably get into this more, but even just through the principles of justice and reason, irrespective of religious tradition or having any faith at all, I think we can demonstrate the danger to society of taking other people's lives into our own hands. Now, right away, people may jump up with the rebuttal that, well, what about self-defense? What about the military? What about in places where governments execute prisoners who are sentenced to death? Yes, we know that there are instances where people's lives are taken by others, and we do not condemn that as an unjustifiable act. But the only thing that those all have in common with each other is self-defense and the defense against an aggressor for the sake of the common good. That's the only manner in which a person may act that results in the death of another. Here we were talking about a Catholic moral principle we refer to as double effect, where there is a foreseen but unintended consequence that we know will come as a consequence of trying to achieve this other good. And so in the case of self-defense, it's not me wanting to kill you, it's me wanting to protect my own life, which I do have the right to do. And you posing a threat to my life may inadvertently end up meeting the end of yours simply out of my good intention to protect my own. That cannot become the justification for freely ending someone else's life because they're suffering. Because simply put, there is no escape to suffering in this life. And forever, people have thought that suicide is the only way to escape suffering. And that's why when they become so burdened and find their suffering so unbearable, that is why they have resorted to that. But to then institutionalize that and even enshrine it in medical terminology and just set it out on the table for people as though here are your variety of treatment options, that now we're talking about something totally different than the practice of medicine.
What if a person, though, just wants to die? They could come back and say, well, it's my choice. It's my body. How can you force me to live if I want to die?
Mm-hmm. Our lives are for the sake of other people. We do not bring ourselves into existence. And so we do not bring ourselves out of existence. That is not up to us to choose. And again, that's just a kind of a logical conclusion to be drawn. If you did not author your own existence, you do not thereby have the right or the freedom to take yourself out of existence. It's an act of rebellion against nature, against ourselves, and against the one who gave us life. So no, you don't have you have a right to live because your life was bestowed upon you. But you do not have a right to die. That's not logical. And it goes against our instincts. If you step out onto the street and you notice a vehicle's coming, you jump back without thinking about it. You don't have to look for another second and decide whether or not you should let this oncoming vehicle strike you. Because we have an instinct to protect ourselves. the survival instinct. Instincts are bestowed upon us precisely to serve the purpose of our existence. And so it would not be instinctual for us to try and survive if we weren't meant to live. Now that being said, we have another problem on the other side of the spectrum, which is avoiding death at every cost and almost trying to become like God on the other side, which is to say, I will never die. And we must keep someone alive at every cost and as long as possible. We also, in our moral tradition, do not believe in that. And I think that is partly what has ushered in this greater interest in or urgency for euthanasia. There has been some hubris of assuming we have the power to keep people alive almost forever, as it were, and that we're not meant to live forever either, at least on this planet. As we're continuously reminded, this planet is passing away, this planet is falling apart, as all organic things do, and so our lives also will come to an end. But the idea that we should be able to keep someone alive indefinitely is exactly why I think some people say, well, let's just get this over with. So those are some of the dynamics that I think have all sort of woven together to produce the current situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have a situation within Canada, as mentioned before, called MAID, Medical Assistance in Dying. It's law. So in 2016, that's when it became legal to request this. And it was under certain conditions for grievous and irremediable medical conditions, and their death was reasonably foreseeable. So a person had, when they were applying for this, they had to meet certain criteria. So they had to be really sick and their death had to be foreseeable. That was in 2016. But then we've seen the eligibility criteria expanded and continuously expanded from that situation then in 2021 to include those who have disabilities. So their death is not immediately foreseeable. Then coming up right away here in March 2023, a different situation where the eligibility is expanded to those whose sole medical condition is mental illness. What's your reaction to this?
I hate to be flippant, but it's, I told you so. This is what the church was saying before the 2016 legislation came in. This is what ethicists around the world have said any time this conversation comes up. If there was ever a slippery slope argument, it's this one. Because who are you to adjudicate another person's suffering? To have ever thought, as a government body passing legislation, you would be capable of determining how severe someone else's suffering was, and whether or not it was justified for them to want to kill themselves or to just finally be dead, was absurd. Again, it's this hubris, this idea that I know best, we the government knows. No, you don't, because you don't know the individual circumstances of people's lives. And now you put someone else in charge of having to make a determination, because it's the law, that this person is allowed to ask for medical assistance in dying, and this person is not. Sorry, your suffering isn't eligible to receive assistance in committing suicide. That was never going to last. People would never accept that that was how it would have to be. And so we said, you're opening a Pandora's box, and there will be no closing it. And I'm afraid that I shouldn't be so cynical, but I think it was well understood that that was the case, and they fully intended to just gradually ease people into being okay with this, deciding that this was something normal now in society, in order to widely open up the access to it for, I think, far different reasons.
In March here, and now it expands to those who are suffering from mental illness. it just seems so twisted to me that a person who is struggling to find meaning and purpose in life goes to healthcare professionals who typically are there to help a person, but their help is, well, now, well, you know, there's always a possibility now that you can just take your life. In a person's darkest moment, when they need compassion, they need help, they need a human touch, they are pointed to death. It just doesn't seem like a person can make, the part of the law is like making informed consent. But it just seems totally illogical that a person who's suffering with mental illness and is a really dark place is able to make really good decisions.
Well, look, the church has, some would have from the outside looked in and said, oh, the church has really softened its position on the consequences of suicide, or has even gone so far as to change the teaching on suicide. And I know why people would come to that conclusion. In the past, you know, in bygone eras or centuries, it was understood that if someone took their own life, they were not even admitted Christian burial. They could not have a funeral mass, and they could not be buried in a Catholic cemetery, because it was seen as the incontrovertible fact that your last act in this life was to violate God's law and end your own life. So what else could it be than an instant mortal sin that condemns you to hell? I think the church has very wisely, through further contemplation and consideration, stood back and asked the question, what exactly happens in the final moments of life? And can we be so sure that someone has not, in a moment of desperation, taken a decision that after initiating it is no longer reversible, but maybe in their dying moment can repent or realize that even though they're not going to be able to save themselves now, they wish they hadn't done this, or perhaps they even have an encounter with our Lord who shows them his mercy in their dying moment. We can't know that. And so because we can't know that, we don't any longer act in a way that appears to issue a judgment on the state of a person's soul because of the manner in which they died. So I think that that is very helpful for us to see that development in thinking, if I can call it that. But one of the reasons the church has arrived at that conclusion is precisely because we say we cannot know a person's conscience, and we cannot be sure that they were free to make the decision. We make impulsive decisions all the time, but one of the conditions for mortal sin is that you were fully knowledgeable of the evil or the gravity of the sin and free to choose it. And because we know so much more now the circumstances of mental health and just how compromised a person's freedom can be, I think we have rightly come to the conclusion that we cannot make judgments on a person's freedom based on the extreme depression or anxiety or debilitating mental illness that they're suffering with. Therefore, how then can we say that a person is actually in their right mind to even be capable of informed consent because of mental illness to just decide that, yes, I should end my life? It is completely incompatible with reason, but we are living in a time where, you know, some have called it the post-rational era. We don't think at all anymore. We only emote. We feel, and then we act based upon our feelings. We don't think. And our illustrious Prime Minister here in Canada has gone on repeatedly about the crisis of teen suicide on our Indigenous reserves, because he loves, it seems, noticing everything that's plaguing our Indigenous people, and then turns around and promotes and advances legislation to enshrine in law a person's right to request to be helped to kill themselves. Well, the utter incompatibility of that should be enough to say, whoa, put the brakes on, we don't understand what we're doing here. But no, We just keep watching the train roll downhill, and it just keeps picking up speed, and it will go off the rails.
Even I just think of people who are struggling with mental illness, and now they want to get help. So now they go to mental health professionals who now give them the option of ending their life as part of that help. They may have never intended to that, but now they're seeking help with mental illness, and now that becomes an option.
I should qualify something that, at least in the legislation, it is foreseen that that could happen. And so they do say that people are not supposed to be presented with, as an option, the request for medical assistance in dying. They have to voluntarily request information about it. But I can tell you now with absolute certainty, this is not secondhand hearsay, I have dealt with people who have explicitly had it offered to them at the time of their, in these cases I'm thinking of, their terminal diagnoses with things. But as though, just so you're aware, we could provide you with some information about this if you feel that it would be worth exploring. Of course it's being offered. If it's being done, why wouldn't you present it as an option? So to have ever thought that you could control people from not presenting something as an option when it is an option is ridiculous.
I'm just looking at an article from the Daily Mail. It says, disabled Canadian Army veteran Paralympian blasts government for offering to euthanize her when she complained about how long it was taking to get installed a stair lift at her home. So there's your example. Someone needs a lift in their home. They're disabled, and it's presented to them, well, how about instead of a stair lift, we consider euthanasia? Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll never forget, I was probably in grade 8 or 9, in that grade level, everyone just sort of stands out in the schoolyard at recess doing nothing, and there was an argument that broke out between some students, and I'll never forget this guy yelled back at someone else, "Go kill yourself." And we all just gasped, like, how can you say that to someone? Now, this is a long time ago, and thinking about a situation like this was not on anyone's horizon, but it has wounded my soul just remembering, hearing that guy, "Go kill yourself." But I'm sorry, did the federal government, did the Office of Veterans Affairs not just say exactly the same thing to that person, except they just politely said, "You may kill yourself if that would help." It's so shocking, but at the same time, the deterioration of our collective consciousness and of our society itself, these are the logical consequences. This is what comes when you stop thinking and you drive God out of all public discourse.
I wanted to bring up to you something that's happening in Ontario with the College of Surgeons and Physicians. They were looking for feedback on a policy that they're looking to implement. And I'll throw the policy proposal up on the screen. And it states, when completing the medical death certificate, physicians must list illness, disease, or disability leading to the request for MAID as the cause of death, and must not make any reference to MAID or the medications administered on the certificate. This seems incredibly deceptive. We then won't know exactly how many people have requested MAID. Your thoughts on this?
Well, the very first thing Adam and Eve did after eating the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was to hide. They went and hid themselves from God because of their shame. They knew they had done wrong. They knew they had violated the one and only thing God had told them not to do, despite all of the other freedom he had given them. And they hid. And we have never stopped hiding whenever we sin. That's what this is. It is in a way, I think it's terrible, obviously, for exactly the reason that you just said. We want to not know or let it be publicly knowable how many people actually are requesting this. Now, on the other side, they'll argue to say, well, it's because we don't want to inflate in people's consciousness that they should be choosing it. Okay, that's a good outcome of an already evil thing. God can bring good out of evil. But the real reason is abundantly clear. And it's that we still think there's a stigma attached to it. And we shouldn't be advertising this. We know we shouldn't do it. Sin always looks for the darkness. And so those who are saying that this is the way that it should be are implicitly admitting their own guilt before it even happens, before they even execute someone. They want no evidence of it. But I feel very badly for those physicians who will participate in this, because no one is without a conscience. And this will catch up to them. I assure them it will catch up to them. And they can tell themselves all they want that they have done the most merciful thing in the world by helping someone end their unimaginable suffering. But they will not be able to live with that forever. As someone who has heard more confessions than I can count, you just don't live some things down. And people know the difference between suffering with someone, which is exactly what the word compassion means in Latin, cum passio, to suffer with them, and putting someone out of their misery. We all cry at the old movie, Old Yeller, that dog that gets put down behind the barn, because we just know this is so sad, this is not right, to our pet. We have a reaction about that to our pet. But more for your mother or your father or your grandmother. I understand why the person asks for it. And I understand why the family who feels they have to go along with it believes that they have no other choice. Like, how else can they honor their family members' wishes? But I just can't. Well, I'm repeating myself. You mm-hmm. don't escape that afterwards.
The one characteristic about sin, it seems to me, is that it takes you farther than you want to go. We consent to something, and it just seems like it leads to something else, leads to something else, leads to something else. And I've noticed that in my life, and all of a sudden I've gone farther than I had initially wanted to go. And it seems as a society, this is what is happening. The slippery slope of this ever-expanding eligibility for MAID in our country. And I'm wondering, where does it end? Because recently, the College of Physicians in Quebec went one step further. They are suggesting that MAID, medical assisted in dying, be appropriate and be given for infants who are up to the age of one, who are born with severe malformations and grave and severe syndromes for which their prospective of survival is null. I feel like this is now crossing a new line. What do you think? How is this a little bit different than what we've talked about up to this point?
Maybe you've seen the famous depiction or the comic cartoon of the snake that eats its own tail. That's what this is. It's no surprise that a culture that so adamantly promotes the freedom to execute children in the womb would then also convince itself that it's merciful to execute them outside of the womb. It was inevitable that we would arrive at that conclusion. And then to call it medical assistance in dying. First of all, a physician is incapable of saying your perspective of survival is null. They just are. They are incapable of that. You can only declare that at the time of someone's death. And now, I'm not arguing to make the exception the rule, because that's a logical fallacy, that miracles happen. New cures can be discovered. Treatments can be... Well, what's the point in doing all of the research that we're doing if we don't believe there's a reasonable hope that things we formerly thought were a death sentence could now be treated and managed? It's a contradiction. We are riddled with contradictions. And so we cannot say, you will not survive. You can say, we do not see how this will be survivable. This is how we recommend doing the most that we can, that we know how to do, to promote some degree of life. But we are not entitled to not suffer in this life. And that's unfortunately the reason that we find ourselves at these crossroads. Because suffering is painful and no one wants to suffer, we assume that if we do suffer, it's supposedly our right to make it stop. And it isn't. I think it's important too that we, in a moment with such a consciousness of equity, especially racially inspired equity, the euthanasia movement was born out of the eugenics movement. Okay, notice the beginning of those two words, eugenics and euthanasia. And eugenics was the idea that we could purify our race, that you can make the gene pool advance superiorly and on an accelerated way, other than just in what Darwin advanced through natural selection, by artificial selection, by going in and deciding who are the ones worth keeping and who are the ones to be dispensed with. We live in a time where I'm exhausted at hearing every person you don't like being called a Nazi or being compared to Adolf Hitler. But if we're going to make that comparison on anything, this is it. That was exactly the campaign that was undertaken, was to purify the race of those who were considered less than the superior people. And so eugenics employed euthanasia. Get rid of the people that we should not have, so that they don't keep clogging up the gene pool with their inferiority. Now, we hear that in our modern sensibility and rightly stand aghast to it. But if that's where this was born from, can you expect that it's ever going to find a good destination? And so now doctors are saying, let's kill babies even after they're born. It's no surprise.
It sounds to me that this is just a different form of murder, but sanitized, and we call it compassion. Because if we allow this to happen within our country, well, then what is preventing a parent from deciding, well, why stop at 1 year old? Why not two? Why not three? Why not five? If we can't say a person begins at conception, then any line along the development is justifiable, isn't it?
Exactly. That's exactly it. And I think, unfortunately, we're at a moment where it's hard to press the stop button. The whole thing is spiraling out of control. But this has been foreseen. You know, both, ironically, Pope Benedict XVI and Pope Francis, when asked about their favorite work of fiction, they both point to the same book that they think they call their favorite book, which is called Lord of the World by Hugh Robert Benson, who became a Catholic priest eventually. I think at the time he wrote the book, he had already converted. But he wrote in 1909 this very apocalyptic tale of how the end of the world comes about. And by the time the end of the world was near, one of the features in their very enlightened society were what they called euthanasia clinics. And you just went and checked yourself in, and no one had to know that you were there. And a nurse came in and helped you put on this mask and turn on this dial, and then you just die. And that, at the time that people would have read this, would have thought, well, that must be the end of the world. Look at us now. And I don't know what much difference there is between that which he associated with being a sign of apocalypse to what is happening in our current state of affairs.
So recently I went on Amanda Achtman's Twitter feed. I was pleasantly surprised to see all the wonderful content she had on there, but something caught my attention and I wanted it to refer back to a comment you said about the Nazis. Because some might think Father is just being so over the top here referring to the Nazis, and in this current situation is completely different, and they might say something like that. What she has on her Twitter feed is this. She said, in 1941, a Nazi made a table showing how much money the government would save by preventing persons with disabilities from living 10 years longer. In 2020, the Parliamentary Budget Officer in Canada released a table of the reduction in healthcare costs through euthanasia. As you can see on the screen, we have 6,456 deaths by MAID, saving the healthcare system of a total of $86.9 million. Father, what's the problem with this?
Well, I'm very proud of Amanda being from here in Calgary. She's a brilliant young woman who has pointed exactly to something I was not necessarily going to bring up, but I signaled to it earlier in our conversation when I said, I'm afraid that there might be other reasons why the government is opening the Pandora's box quite on purpose, not to later say, oh, we're so sorry, we never thought that the slippery slope was a real thing. They are very happy to ride the slippery slope down to budget cuts. Forgive me for being so cynical, but I have every reason to believe that this is ultimately where this is going. Because in the end, in this world of total obsession with money, things almost always come down to the money. And in a country with socialized healthcare, which I'm not knocking, but that's what we have here, which is extremely expensive, in a time when the people above the age of 65 outnumber the age group that should have replaced them, because we've aborted and contracepted ourselves out of existence. And now we live longer than ever because of all of our wondrous advances in medicine. That is a perfect storm for saying, we can't afford this. Combine that with this relentless Malthusian concept that the overpopulation is killing the world and we need to reduce the world's population, we need to get population growth under control. All of these factors come flying together and they create this circumstance that says, maybe in addition to mercifully helping someone out of their suffering, we could save a lot of money. And the minute that you get dual motivations, it's very hard to know which one is actually motivating you. The daughter of an aging parent who, because of their suffering, is asking for MAID is not thinking about budget. Okay, I want to make that clear. I don't think that. The people who advance the legislation are. And we would be foolish not to think that that was part of it. And if that's the case, now we're not only getting to decide whether or not I should have the right over someone else's life and to determine the degree of their suffering, now we're putting a price on their head. And I don't know how much worse it can get than that.
So the clouds are dark over our country. I mean, I am also a little bit very pessimist about the future and where this is heading, because I don't think it's going to stop. There's going to be more and more disordered responses to life as we continue on. How do we get out of this? Like, I don't know. I don't have an answer. I don't have a clear, this is, do this, 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 and this, and this. I want an answer. How do we reverse? How do we get out of this culture of death?
Archbishop Fulton Sheen famously had an Emmy Award-winning, extremely popular television show that used to air on NBC called Life is Worth Living. And as in most things that that great man did, I think the very title of his show was prophetic. Life is worth living. Do we give witness to that? Do we show that we believe that, both by the cheerfulness with which we try and live our own life and by the love that we show to people who find their lives unbearable to live? That, I think, is the only way out of this culture of death, is to overwhelm it and drown it in a culture of life, as St. John Paul II called it, by sitting at the bedside of our aging and dying parents and grandparents and just reminding them, you are not a burden to me. Mm. It is an honor and a joy to be able to have this time with you. I watched my grandfather, to whom in a way I owe my vocation, suffer and die from ALS. And those final months of his life shaped me and made me who I am. And I will never forget, once while he still could barely get words out, a cousin came to visit and said, "Oh, Uncle Pasquale, how are you feeling today?" He said, "I feel like hell and I wish I was dead." I knew he felt like that. And so we did everything in our power to make what time he had left with us in this life worth living. And then he was surrounded by his entire family at his bedside at the time of his death. He received the final sacraments and he died in total peace. That is what we owe our loved ones. We cannot fix the problem of suffering in this life. Only our Lord will fix the problem of suffering in the new heaven and the new earth for which we are waiting. But while we are waiting, we have to wait with each other and comfort one another and remind them that they are loved and that, as hard as it may be to believe at times, their life is worth living.
Thank you, Father Cristino. And friends who are watching, this is an important message. So I'm going to ask you to do something. Please share this video with as many people as you can, because the content that we've covered here really, really is important. Life indeed is worth living. Thank you so much for your time and spending this conversation with us.